Hello again and welcome to another episode of Voices from SA. My name is Nicholas Claude. Thanks for joining me wherever you are, whether it's in a plane, a train, an automobile, or the top of a mountain. I hope all is well. My guest this week is the science writer, climate activist, and advocate for psychedelic medicine, Léonie Joubert. So in this episode, we chat about a number of themes around climate change, climate activism, that I've touched on in recent discussions, for instance, with Kevin Bloom and John Clark. But we also delve into her writing and research about the use of magic mushrooms to treat certain mental health issues, such as depression. Léonie and I chatted about her path into science writing, her recent crisis of confidence in her own work and, you know, what she was doing, having the strength and purpose to carry on advocating both for climate action and the use of psilocybin, psychedelic magic mushrooms in medicine. We touched on the current research that certainly indicates that psychedelic medicine will be in mainstream medical use, certainly in the United States, UK and Australia in the near future. So please enjoy now my chat with Léonie. Hello. Yeah, I'm just going to, if I sit here like that, you can just say a few words, please. Are you sitting comfortably?
I am. Can you hear me okay?
So you can just introduce yourself.
Great. So, Léonie Joubert, science writer based in Cape Town.
Okay, that's fine. We're looking good. Léonie, thanks so much for your time.
It's great to have you here in my lounge. Thank you.
In Rondebosch. Yeah, I'm actually in Cape Town. My brother's out from London, so I've taken the opportunity now to try and catch up with a couple of people in Cape Town. So I thank you for your time. And it's interesting because I think I got your name when I first started this, Sam Kelly, who's a mutual friend.
Yes.
She put me onto your Aquanauts.
Okay, the Psychonauts.
She put me onto the Aquanauts. Not a bad, that'll be a side project. Sam Kelly put me onto the Psychonauts, which is it's an audio book, I suppose, in a way.
Yes, it's a serialized audio book, which is released on a podcast platform.
Yeah. And I want to come to that a little bit later in our conversation, but it's just interesting that, you know, when you sort of got into the thread after I'd spoken to Kevin, then I recognized that name, and then I sort of did a bit of research, and oh yes, that's Sam's friend, and so I made contact, and it's good to meet you.
Thank you.
You're sort of, well, on your webpage, you talk about science writing, climate change, urban development, food security, mental health. There's a lot of things going on there. It seems to me that your path into science writing happened when you were on the SAO Gullis, which is the South African maritime research vessel, if I can put it that way. I think this is the older ship, because I think there's a new one launched in the last couple of years.
Yes.
You went down to Marion Island.
Yes, I was.
How did you end up as a... You were a journalist then?
Yeah, so... excuse me. So it was a wonderful accident, actually, how I ended up on the Agulhas. I finished my degree at Rhodes, where I studied history and journalism.
Okay, nice.
Which the history was transformative. It just turned my worldview upside down in the most wonderful way. But when I moved to Cape Town to get a job, as many people from the Eastern Cape do, my parents were living in Hogsback and had for many years.
Oh, that's where you're from?
Yes.
Oh, in that magical part of the land.
Yes. But I moved to Cape Town, and the only job I could get was with a lifestyle magazine, which, you know, was an opportunity to start earning money and learning the skills, but was actually not really where my passion and competence lay. So after about 3.5 years, I took a very brave and risky decision to go freelance, and at the same time found an opportunity to do a master's in science journalism through Stellenbosch University.
Oh, wow, that existed even.
It did.
That kind of course?
I had no aspirations to do a master's, but the reason I took it was because it gave me an opportunity to get onto the SA Agalas and travel down to Marion Island with a group of climate change scientists. Now, Antarctica has always been somewhere that I wanted to visit because my father spent 4 years, 4 summers down in the Antarctic with the British Antarctic Survey. So this has been part of my family mythology in a way.
But what was your dad doing there?
Before he became an agricultural engineer and ended up at Fort Hare University, he spent a few years working with the British Antarctic Survey. And he was the second mate on a ship that went down 4 summers in a row.
Brilliant.
So this is very much part of my the family story.
When would that have been that he was down there then?
Would that have been
in the 50s?
The 1960s, yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, there are fantastic pictures of him as a very young man walking along ice with the emperor penguins next to him. They were still using husky dogs at the time.
Man.
Extraordinary. He still has his old Antarctic gear in his cupboard. So I'd always wanted to get there.
Yeah.
And getting onto
Marion Island was...
It was halfway there. So I really had no... I hadn't even started writing as a science writer. I didn't know I had any aptitude. I'd never really spent much of my life aspiring to be a writer. Hmm. I was a bit of a late developer.
But when you were studying journalism then, what was your... Were you going to be like one of those crack news hounds?
No. I didn't really know what I wanted to do.
Oh, I see.
I really didn't know. Hmm. I just figured out that I would... you know,
find
my way.
Oh, wow.
So I went down to Marion and I...
And so already there's climate changes on the agenda now in 2003.
Absolutely. So I was incredibly privileged that I got to tag along with a team of scientists that were going down to Marion Island to look at all sorts of aspects of how climate change might be impacting on this little living laboratory down in the Southern Ocean. Excuse me. And I really had no idea what I was doing. I just took a notepad with me and a pen and a little camera, and I just jotted down absolutely everything that I saw.
Hmm.
And then I started writing a series of sort of feature-style essays around the history of the island, the scientists I was working with. And I cobbled one of those together into what I thought would be a nice book chapter. And I thought, if all of these stories are coming out of Marion about the impact of climate change on the bird life and the glacier at the center of the island and changing the way the invasive species there are behaving, are there not similar stories back here in South Africa? And so I was incredibly lucky. I spent about a month on the island. I have a notepad scribbled with little hand drawings of penguins and things.
Are those some of the scribblings on your website?
Yes.
As well? Because they're delightful little drawings. I have to say, I'm very impressed.
Thank you.
So you didn't realize you were an artist until you started scribbling those.
Well, I mean, the backstory is that I actually signed up when I went to Rhodes to do a fine art degree.
Oh, man.
And then discovered that I didn't think I was terribly good at that. So I switched to journalism and history.
Jeez. Well, because Rhodes is renowned, I think, both for its art school and its school of journalism.
Yes.
So you were kind of in the right place there either way, weren't you?
Absolutely. I think my career has been a series of fortunate accidents.
Yeah.
I wrote a series of stories about this incredible experience on Marion. The Marion Island experience was transformative in that there's something about stepping away from the hustle and bustle of this modern life, stepping into a wilderness experience, a wilderness space, and Marion really is a real wilderness space.
It's quite bleak. I mean, what is the geography? Is it?
It's interesting.
Is it rock and brush?
Yes. So it's a small volcanic island. It's only a million years old. So the volcanic structure is still showing up. The edge of the island is covered with mires and moss and very sort of small, low vegetation, very green. It's fertilized by the fact that you have loads of seals and penguins living around the skirt of the island. But as you head deeper into the center of the island, that vegetation falls away and you end up with these rocks that are covered in lichen and some moss. And then eventually even that gives way and all you have is the bare bones of this island. And it's
the volcanic rock,
absolutely
the center of the earth, as it were.
Absolutely, I mean the stuff that it all comes from. Yeah. You know, black rock, some red sort of oxidized colored rock, and then at the center there is the remnants of a glacier that is rapidly melting.
Mm. And it was rapidly melting even back then.
It was back then. In fact, I'd love to know how much of it is left.
Sure, I heard. Is it possible? Maybe I'm thinking of another island. That I met some guy or met somebody who knew somebody who'd gone to Marion Island to shoot cats.
Yes. So one of the unfortunate stories about many of the islands like this in the subantarctic is in the 1800s, as people started visiting these islands on ship, they took mice managed to get in, mice and rodents. And then to deal with the mice plagues, people took cats in. And in Marion Island, there was just a small little family of cats. I think it was one female and a few kittens. But these just bred and bred and bred. And eventually there was an absolute inundation of cats that was killing the birds.
Yeah.
So the management of the island took people down, hunters down, to shoot them.
Spend like 6 months just shooting cats. I mean, that can't be good for your mind.
I don't think that could be good for anyone's mental health, no. And they managed to get rid of the cats, but of course the mice are still a major problem and they are also killing the birds.
I suppose there's some sort of metaphor there, isn't there, right, for like just humankind's impact on nature, right? It doesn't have to be sort of emissions or chemicals. It's just us.
Absolutely, wherever we go. I mean, if you look at how humans have moved out of Africa and into pretty much every other continent except Antarctica, wherever we've gone, we've killed out all of the megafauna or most of the megafauna. And now here we are, to quote the writer Richard Powers, we've turned half the planet into a factory farm to support one species. Mm. And even down there on Marion Island, you know, the impact, you can see it.
Yeah. So you've not been back there since 2003.
I was so privileged. I got another chance to go back, and I think it was 2007 or 2008. When I was assisting to write the new environmental management plan for the island.
Okay.
So that was a brief sojourn down.
And could you sort of see visible impact from your memories of your first journey, or is it so gradual that
it's too gradual? And I think this is why environmental change is often a misleading thing.
Hmm.
Professor Rob Nixon wrote a beautiful book called The Slow Violence. Of environmental, I forget the name. But basically he talks about environmental change being a slow burning process.
Yeah.
You know, the
and if people can see something like, oh man, that tree's now, it was there yesterday and now it's gone today, or that, and it's as a result of this and this, then they won't really comprehend somehow.
Absolutely. And I think this is why maybe the climate change thing has become such a distressing thing for me, which we can talk about now or in a while, is this realization that I've spent nearly 20 years writing the story. And the assumption was we would be making a difference by now, and actually it's just getting worse.
Yeah, you do talk, there was a piece on your website where you're talking sort of about having hope. I mean, the solutions journalism about having to keep on keeping on in the face of. Well, I don't think even I now, I've spoken to a couple of people around climate issues recently, and I mean, you know, we could all be dead if you hear some people from within the next 2 years or the next 50 years. And so in such a hopeless sort of situation, it seems you are advocating for what, some kind of belief that we can still help ourselves?
Well, okay, so let me quickly join the Marion Island story with today, and then we can talk about where we go from here. So after the Marion Island trip, I ended up writing a short book that looked at how climate change would impact on much of South Africa's natural spaces, elephants and savannah and frogs and, you know, Marion Island.
All the ecosystems.
All of these different ecosystems. And it was a wonderful opportunity for me to learn how to write, use long-form storytelling to bring in complex science. And it produced the first book that I wrote, Scorched. Result of that, it just set my entire career on the specific path.
And that was in 2006 already that you're writing about this.
Correct. And since then, so I've been using sort of feature-style writing, analysis, and this long-form storytelling to explore these very complex issues around mostly sort of climate change and its impact on us as a country.
And our impact on ourselves,
and how we respond, how we cope. And, I mean, it's been an incredibly rewarding almost 20 years. Hmm. But I think what happened in 2016 is that I woke up on that morning in November to discover that Donald Trump was in the White House. I mean, I went to bed the night before thinking surely Hillary Clinton would get in. And at the same time as, you know, Donald Trump is not just a problematic man. He represents the very system that has got us into the difficulty we are in right now with the climate crisis. And at the same time, Jacob Zuma was once again trying to remove from the Treasury the people that were standing between him and this highly corrupt nuclear deal with the Russians. And at the same time, you know, there were months and months and months of news reports about these extreme weather events that were unfolding around the planet, you know, dreadful wildfires, cyclones, tornadoes,
drought in Cape Town,
terrible droughts. And I had what can only really be described as a proper existential sort of collapse, where I just thought, I've been doing this for nearly 20 years, and I had this sort of naive idea that the arc of history bends towards justice, you know, to quote Martin Luther King. And surely 20 years worth of work would gain traction and
somebody
have made a difference. And then suddenly we end up in the situation where it just seems like things are getting worse. The system is collapsing around us. We have these terrible, dangerous people in power at a time when we need rapid social disruption. And I went into months of real depression thinking, I just don't know why do I get up every day, sit at my desk sometimes for 10 hours, hammering out these stories in real isolation, actually, think and believing that it has a difference when actually it might not. And then I sort of stumbled on this interesting research that was beginning to look at the mental health implications of climate change.
Yeah.
And reading that research as a professional wanting to write about another aspect of climate change, at the same time as seeing almost my own autobiographical story unfolding within the research, it became a very interesting opportunity to think about this at a personal level, hearing so many of my colleagues in the science writing and the activism space, the social justice space, reflecting similar internal turmoil.
Anxiety,
despair, hopelessness, and then seeing what the medical health people were saying about how we find a recovery curve within this. And I think my story of the past 2 or 3 years has been very much following the same recovery curve that they talk about. And it turns out there are wonderful bodies of work from people like Joanna Macy, who comes from a deep Buddhist tradition, where the practice is to acknowledge the grief of seeing the world falling apart around you, the grief of realizing that we're complicit in causing environmental destruction and our own destruction, leaning into that grief and the existential overwhelm, and then within that, finding one's point of agency within society. And it's when you find your point of agency and you're able to leverage that agency that I think your hope returns. And I guess that's where I'm at. It's why I've thrown myself into ridiculously insane hours of climate change writing, of writing about psilocybin mushrooms, which we'll talk about in a minute.
Sure. Yeah.
And it's all part of this this attempt to kind of pull myself out of that feeling of hopelessness.
Mm.
It reminds me of what a friend of mine was saying around, this is someone who was politically very active in the 1980s, when the apartheid state was just a brutal, intractable police state, and it seemed like the system would never be changed.
Mm.
And he said to me, if we had held on to the outcome, we might have given up because it seemed like we would never topple this terrible state. So yeah. We needed to just get up and do it every single day because it was the right thing to do.
Mm.
And the climate crisis feels so much bigger. And if we hold on to the outcome that we will change it, we may not find the reserves to keep going, but we can do little things every day and every month and every year that can help the most vulnerable to be a little bit more resilient. And I think that's where our reserves lie, in terms of keeping on.
It's, I'm not sure if you had a chance to listen to that when I spoke to Professor Francois Engelbrecht, who's based at WITS. He was one of the scientists who wrote the last IPCC report, the 1.5 degrees. And I mean, yeah, that was a pretty bleak picture that he painted for me there. So just on a purely sort of scientific, you know, the cyclones that struck the eastern coast earlier on this year, but in particular, and then the floods in KwaZulu-Natal also over the summer. But you've sort of lived it here in Cape Town with the drought.
Mm.
And you've written a little bit about that. And I'm just wondering, I mean, that was one of the things you mentioned in this mm. particular article, sort of something that gives you hope was people's ability to change behavior. But, I mean, I get the impression that it requires a little bit more than sort of bathing less or using less plastic if we really are going to save ourselves.
Absolutely.
Francois or Professor Engelbrecht was saying, like, emissions, I mean, basically, we need to stop using cars and flying and anything that's causing emission is has got to stop. I mean, the flip side of what he said was like, unfortunately, we're going to need some nuclear power. So there's kind of, you know, where do you? Where do we go? Do you think?
Okay, so.
No, that's no problem.
So
I'll keep that one in, but the rest I'll edit out.
So I think one of the shortfalls of the public discourse around climate change is that we focus too much on an individual behavior change around not driving, not flying, what meat we eat, whether we have children. These are very important conversations, but we need a massive social disruption. We need to challenge the political economy that is underlying climate change and has been escalating the problem for 30 years. And that requires a level of social organization and activism that is way beyond just a few well-meaning people not flying anymore or recycling plastic. How we respond to this requires really understanding the system and where understanding these big leverage points are within the system. And that requires sinking our teeth into content at a whole new level, becoming really well-informed. You know, I think we need protesting at our newsrooms to demand that our editors step up. You know, I think one of the big failures as a society is that the press has not covered this with nearly as much urgency. You know, the media is a load-bearing wall in the Fourth Estate. It is critical to getting public and, you know, political discourse moving on these urgent issues. And it's still, you know, many news houses still treat this as a nice little environmental story to have once you've given all of your resources to the important stories like the politics and the economics and the corruption.
Mm.
Actually, this story touches absolutely everything. It is the most important story of our time. And of course, the other one is challenging the politics that allows big corporations to benefit off of having free access to the atmospheric space. You know, large corporations that can continue to pollute put the emissions up into the atmosphere free of charge, and yet the costs of that pollution is getting socialized because you have small communities getting hammered by extreme weather events. If you look just at Mozambique, if you look at Cape Town, how politically and economically unstable a community becomes because of an extreme weather event like a very severe drought, landing on top of all of these other day-to-day operational challenges, day-to-day development challenges. And then you see the fault lines emerging in a community, the local expression of this big global problem. And I mean, what's interesting that comes out of the Cape Town drought experience is in terms of people's behavior, people rallying around trying to solve the problem, people needed to realize how very serious the situation was, but at the same time, they needed to know what they could do in that crisis to be part of the solution. And I think this has a bigger communications implication for climate change. Mm. I do think it's time we are realistic about how bad the situation is, but at the same time we need to start articulating what it is that we can do as individuals and as communities.
I suppose one of the issues around the press is that, you know, the press is owned by essentially a corporate structure that is aligned to the system that is causing the damage in the first place. Is that a naive sort of way of looking at it? Or is it just that environmental stories are really not, unless someone's died or a house has been washed away and there's a nice dramatic picture or story to tell, that's not really seen as newsworthy?
Absolutely. I think there's just this disconnect between a realization that a healthy functioning society is completely dependent on having ecosystem services that work. You know, we need a stable climate. We need regular cold fronts bringing rain. We need healthy soils. We need water systems that take the rain and percolate it down into the ground and fill our dams. Mm. These are absolutely central to survival. And yet most of us are so disconnected from the natural world. I mean, there's a little bit of a hippie saying, you know, we aren't here protecting nature. We are nature protecting itself. And this is absolutely fundamentally true. I think this sort of modern Western, often scientifically... this modern Western view of ourselves as being separate from nature is part of the problem. Hmm. You know, we forget that we are absolutely embedded in nature. We're just another one of the many species on this planet. And without functioning healthy systems, it's tickets for us.
Well, yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, it's... I find it hard to really get my head around how desperate the situation is, because, you know, you turn on the tap, there's water. You turn on you switch on the plug, there's electricity. Everything seems to be so normal, and yet I think it's so far from normal. And you talk about the sort of the weather systems that play a role in our very survival. It seems like this winter was one of the most normal, sort of for the first time in many years, it seems, a good solid rainy winter in Cape Town I don't know what the statistics say, but certainly it would, I imagine, that over the last couple of years. My friend Steve Collins, who I've also had on this podcast, he works a lot with communities and water issues and things like that. And he went to some workshop recently, and the guys were saying basically, well, the only time that people in southern Africa are going to get rain now in the future is through these dramatic weather events. It won't be the normal, it'll be an abnormal weather cycle. So it's almost like things are too far out of kilter even now to risk. I was watching a documentary on groundwater, I think it was in California. The groundwater's gone. You know, they're tracking bees around the country in order to pollinate flowers. This just is a bizarre sort of abnormality to the natural world already.
Yeah, and I think these changes have happened so slowly, and most of us are not paying attention because we're caught up in our day-to-day lives that we don't realize how dramatic the changes are. I'll tell you a moment that happened for me a few weeks ago where I realized how severe this climate situation was. And I guess it ties into the mental health implications, because then I wrote that piece for the Daily Maverick around the mental health collapse that many people might experience as a result of this realization. So we've been talking about the extreme weather events that have been unfolding. And for me, they, I mean, it's alarming, but for me, they were just an example of, you know, that we've been filling up the atmospheric land space with carbon pollution for, you know, decades and decades. But the most, the bulk of the emissions that we've put into the atmosphere have been put there in the past sort of 30 to 50 years.
I understand, yeah.
So in the course of our lifetime. And these extreme weather events, whether it's the severe drought in Cape Town and across southern Africa, whether it's terrible fires, I mean, you had bats falling out of trees dead in Australia during heat waves, entire schools of fish floating belly up in rivers. These are examples of these extreme weather events, which for me are a sign that this pollution in the atmosphere is now starting to spill over and cause harm. But the moment for me this year that really, I mean, it hit me like it was like a tectonic force. I'd just come from an evening, a three-hour discussion of climate change, and I was sitting quietly on my stoop at 10 o'clock at night trying to kind of get my brain to slowly sort of gear down so I could go to bed. And it was the same week when we were seeing all of these news articles around how severe the melting is in the Arctic. And that isn't just the result of an extreme weather event. That looks like, I mean, we're talking very significant melting. That seems to be an indication, not just that we're experiencing these climate shocks, but that we might have slipped across one of those key tipping points into a completely new climate regime. So, you know, earlier this year, our carbon, the concentration of carbon in the atmosphere reached 415 parts per million.
Yes.
Now, according to the IPCC, the last time carbon concentrations were this high was about 3 million years ago. And the average temperature of the Earth was about around 1.5 to almost 4 degrees warmer than it is today. So, and of course, the threshold we're trying to avoid crossing is 1.5 degrees.
Yeah.
So now this, it suddenly hit me. It was literally like an existential moment where I realized we have this very optimistic goal that the IPCC is setting for us. Let's not move beyond 1.5 degrees. But our carbon concentration levels in the atmosphere are already way beyond that. So we're already set to overshoot that. So if most of these emissions have been put up in the atmosphere in the course of your and my lifetime, how on earth are we going to make the dramatic handbrake turn to our entire global economy to slow emissions in time to reach this completely unrealistic goal?
I mean, it was quite, for me, an eye-opener when Professor Engelbrecht, you know, quite a softly spoken young Afrikaner, who didn't strike me as being anyone who was going to take to the streets, but he mentioned the word revolution. He said we need a revolution. But I mean, how does that look? Because it's kind of like the genie's out the bottle in terms of technology. Maybe we touch on the role of technology. He says, of course, technology is not going to save us. All of these solutions are purely science fiction. But I'm just, if we are going to sort of save ourselves, do we have to go back to the pre-industrial age? I mean, is it going to be like horse-drawn carriages and sailboats and things like that? Because that's, I sometimes wonder what it looks like, this new world, if we're going to save our planet. If it's a no-emission planet, what does it look like? Do you ever sort of think about, do you ever imagine that?
So I don't want to speak too much about the technological future because I'm not an expert on that. I'm more interested in the political economy underlying the emissions problem. So we need, the kind of revolution we need is massive change to a system that allows the corporate capture of the atmosphere. So, you know, you have large multinational corporations around the world. Some are fossil fuel based, some are, you know, some of the, you know, like the oil industry. These are corporations that need to be throttled back radically. So that is, there needs to be a big political pushback against that. You know, in South Africa, for instance, what does our future look like? We need decentralized renewable energy. We have the technology that's available to us. It's very cheap relative to new coal. It's entirely realistic to run our grid off of solar and wind if the decentralized grid is run properly and built properly. The biggest threat to that, the biggest hurdle to achieving that, is the fact that we have massive vested interests in government and in the private sector that are pro-coal and pro-nuclear. It's vested interests, it's political patronage, and it's corruption. And this has come through on just about every transparency platform in the past decade. And we are not going to switch our grid to a lower carbon one and plan around that so we have a just transition for people in the coal industry if we don't have political will and regulation, etc. So what does revolution look like in South Africa? It looks like South Africans standing up and demanding that our government, the people responsible for our energy grid, move away from these vested interests and that the corruption at that level gets stopped. Of course, how we do that is a different matter.
Because there has been some move towards at least broadening the introduction of sustainable energy into the grid, as far as I understand. But, I mean, you're saying that's been rather a piecemeal effort and...
I don't want to go too much into that.
Okay.
Because I haven't... there's a lot to talk about, but it's going to take us quite far away from the mental health side. I don't know if you want to...
No, that's fine. I'm just... because I'm interested in government policy as well, of course, and where you see government standing on this, because there does seem to be a bit of a dilemma in a way, or at least the government's at a kind of crossroads in terms of what direction it needs to be taking. You want to grow the economy, you want to employ people, but that's still seems to be very much sort of old economy, mining, extractive, that kind of thing. Let's move to the psychonauts, if I can, because it's interesting. You were saying, you know, that you feel the path now is, if we want to change the structure of our political economy, it's kind of It's mass action. It's the kind of action that ended apartheid, is kind of what you're saying. Now, at the same time, when you're talking about psychedelic medicine and the use of particularly psychedelic drugs in the form of magic mushrooms to help people to help people just cope with their day to day, I think that's how you're kind of putting it, and you'll hopefully explain that in a little bit more depth. You're also saying there should be some kind of now mass action for that sort of change as well. What I want to do is now just introduce this other path of your journalism, this looking at the mental health consequences of societal breakdown as a result of climate change, and then saying that one way for people to cope with this would be to trip out on magic mushrooms on a regular basis.
Okay, so this is an interesting story. So let me go back to 2016 when I mentioned to you this bit of an existential crisis started with Donald Trump and Jacob Zuma.
Started taking a lot of mushrooms, did you?
So let's go back to 2016, where I was in the middle of this bit of an existential crisis. You know, Trump, Jacob Zuma, extreme weather events, feeling like my entire...
Did you have kind of a nervous breakdown?
No, not a nervous breakdown, but just slipping into a deep despondency. You know, I realized that I had been getting up every single day for literally 17 years. Grinding away at this story, feeling like I'm sitting in the corner of the room whispering to myself because I don't feel like my work has huge traction, and then realizing that things just aren't getting better. And I thought, why have I been doing this? My entire adult life, my work feels like it has achieved nothing. But then, so it did. It was one of those kind of midlife crises where you think, well, what is the point of getting up and doing this every day? And things are only getting worse. And then in the midst of that, something remarkable happened. I started writing a story. It was just a quirky little story about a subculture here in Cape Town. And this is a community of people who use psychedelic mushrooms for their own sort of spiritual growth and self-actualization. And the story hinged on a court case around a woman in Somerset West, a retiree, the most sort of ordinary sort of grandmotherly type person you could possibly meet.
Granny next door.
The granny next door. Her name is Monica Kromhout, and she was arrested allegedly for having 2 kilograms of dried psilocybin mushrooms, which is a lot of mushrooms.
It's a healthy amount.
And she was charged with, I believe it's possession and dealing or something. And of course, because psilocybin mushrooms are illegal alongside, you know, the big guns. Like
LSD and cocaine. And
actually, cocaine I don't think it's in the same category as... we're talking heroin and crystal meth. So, you know, that volume of mushrooms would have meant probably
a jail term
of about 15 years.
Shit.
So in order to challenge this, she managed to get a stay of prosecution. And then she wanted to start a high court process to challenge the law, which makes this psilocybin mushrooms illegal. Because her argument is that they're not dangerous and addictive, and that they actually have huge therapeutic and spiritual benefit. Anyway, the story behind that is long and unfolding. But what I thought would be just one feature article for a local newspaper, I then suddenly realized was a much bigger story. There was actually a whole book here, because I started to look into the medical research coming from abroad. Really legitimate medical schools like Johns Hopkins,
yes.
Imperial College London, right. New York University, where some early clinical trials was showing extraordinary breakthroughs in using psilocybin mushrooms to treat depression, to treat end-of-life anxiety in cancer patients, to treat alcohol and nicotine dependence. Really extraordinary. So I thought, let's start working on a book. And I wasn't able to get a local publisher interested. I think the story was just too weird and marginal. But the story felt too important to not do it. So I started working literally in after hours, weekends, nights, between sort of paying jobs. I just started writing story after story. And so that's how the Psychonauts happened. It's an entirely self-funded, self-published effort. It's amateur broadcasting. I don't have any podcasting or broadcasting skills.
No, we just keep on trucking.
But it has been a remarkable opportunity to bring together stories from the underground community here in South Africa with the clinical research coming from abroad about the potential of this medicine. And then what sort of legislative changes, what needs to happen in South Africa for this to become medicine. So I started this about 2 years ago, and the remarkable thing is that the story of psilocybin medicine for self-actualization or for treating mental illness actually turns out to be hand in glove with how we possibly as communities need to steel ourselves so that we can handle the existential crisis that comes with climate change at the same time as bringing about the social disruption that we need. Because one of the interesting side effects of regular use of a psychedelic like psilocybin mushrooms is anti-establishment thinking. I mean, it's no surprise that the 1960s anti-war movement was fueled by psychedelics use. It somehow makes people challenge the establishment and challenge current ways of thinking. And and psilocybin mushrooms looks like it's one of those ways to get people to stand back and realize that we're fish swimming through water and we don't even realize the water is around us anymore. This is a way of getting people to challenge the system.
It's quite... that's, I suppose, one could say revolutionary, because it's kind of going against Big Pharma in a way as well, isn't it? It's a bit like the sort of... legalization of marijuana for medical use kind of movement. I mean, do you think that's played a role in this sort of development of this thinking?
It's a complicated question to answer. I mean, the interesting thing about cannabis and about psilocybin mushrooms is that they are very easy for cottage industries to grow and distribute, and these are very safe substances to use. So they don't need to be medicalized in the same way that other sort of mental health drugs might need to be. But there is concern, you know, SSRIs, antidepressants that are traditionally used, you know, these have to be made in a lab. They are they're a drug that you have to take every day to keep in your system.
Yes.
In order for them to have benefits.
For your chemical balance to.
Absolutely.
To become normalized or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. Whereas a medical treatment like psilocybin mushrooms, you don't have to take it every day. Mm. You just need maybe one or two or three supervised deep dose sessions over a series of months, and to possibly have these benefits, the mood stabilizing and well-being benefits of that one or two or three supervised doses can last for weeks or even months after after the exposure to the substance. So, of course, that suddenly means a much, much more affordable treatment. And it doesn't have to be lab-synthesized psilocybin. So it doesn't have to become part of that big, expensive value chain that traditionally comes with pharmaceutical drugs. So it is a very political thing. And of course, you know, you've spoken with some of the people in the field of the cannabis work, you know, where there is this concern that the small producers will be shut out of the system because powerful lobbyists are able to kind of capture that space and ring fence medical cannabis for their own profit.
Well, I don't know if it's happened, but I'm imagining that Philip Morris and companies like that are getting into marijuana production in the United States in a massive way. But that would be you're going to see like proper industrially packaged marijuana cigarettes now in those states where marijuana is legalized.
I imagine that. I think where the social disruption comes in is that because plants like cannabis and mushrooms like psilocybin mushrooms are actually so easy to grow that regardless of what state regulation happens that favors the pharmaceuticals, the little cottage industries will always be able to thrive.
You say that they're safe drugs, but people do react differently to drugs, don't they? So, I suppose I would just put that caveat into the discussion. And I mean, what you say clearly in the podcast and the writing around this is that, you know, it should be treated with respect, and that you need to be under supervision, if not of a medically trained person, somebody who kind of understands the effects of particularly the psilocybin, the mushrooms.
So, you know, one of the unfortunate things about the cultural attitudes towards substances is, you know, because a lot of drugs get thrown into the same category, so heroin, crystal meth, LSD, psilocybin, the assumption is that they work on the body in the same way and that they're all equally dangerous and harmful or whatever. But when you look at individual drugs, and I include alcohol in that, nicotine in that, and one could even argue that sugar is a drug because it is addictive and it doesn't have any nutritional value for us. And then all of these other drugs that are illicit and have such a bad reputation. Every one of these drugs has a different, it impacts on our body in a different way. It impacts on our psyche in a different way. And it needs to be treated in its own context. So it's not useful to throw in psychedelics with heroin or with alcohol in terms of the risks and harms. So that is just one of the sort of educational things that needs to come through. It's very well known what the potential harms and risks are with psychedelics, and experienced users have documented this very well. So just very interestingly, in 2010, a panel that was an independent panel in the United Kingdom did a review of what the harms and risks were associated with the 20 most widely used substances in the UK. So alcohol, nicotine, cocaine, crystal meth, right through to mushrooms and LSD, and MDMA, which is ecstasy, the party drug ecstasy. And they published a seminal report in the Lancet Journal where they showed that alcohol, cocaine, nicotine, cannabis were way, way, way more risky and harmful for individuals and society than mushrooms or LSD. So the risks and harms with LSD and mushrooms and other psychedelics, if you take a big dose and you enter an altered state, and it can be quite bewildering for some people.
I remember the first time I had a bewildering experience.
Would you mind saying what that was on, or would you prefer not to?
We used to take quite a bit of acid back in the day, but it wasn't even really in tranquil circumstances. You know, it was at the club, like
absolutely,
when you're really banging it.
That's the worst place to take it.
Some OMS or Dr. Hoffman's.
So that is a perfect example of how not to do it. Hmm. You know, you don't want to do it in a club. You don't want to do it in a confined space. You want to do it somewhere where you're safe and comfortable, and you can completely sink into the experience. Hmm. And whether you are doing a psychedelic for recreational purposes, whether you're doing it for a deeper dose for a kind of a spiritual or self-actualizing experience, or if you're doing it specifically to handle depression, you want to do it with a sober, supervised person watching over you. You want to be warm and comfortable and safe. You absolutely have to have music. I mean, music is like the umbilical cord that holds you in place while you're floating in this unusual space.
That'll be your connection back to Earth in a
absolutely
way.
Absolutely. Huh. So if you get the set and setting right, a deep psychedelic experience can be an absolutely transformative thing. Hmm. And, I mean, the interesting thing about psychedelics, you know, many of the natural psychedelics have been used for thousands of years, sure, by different indigenous communities.
Yeah.
And they've been
the
used...
The shaman and all that.
Exactly.
Of, yeah.
So they've been used in a very carefully curated social context. And it was only in the 1930s and 40s that psychedelics were introduced into Western society. And it was through the medical community. The psychiatric community, mostly in the States, discovered psychedelics and realized that there was this opportunity to understand how the human mind works. And it's something to do with this kind of spiritual experience that you have in a deep psychedelic state that brings on, they call it the mystical experience, but it seems to be this encounter with the numinous, you know, whether you're an atheist or a Catholic or a Buddhist, you know, you have an encounter with something that feels bigger than yourself. Mm. And the research from the medical community that is working with these substances for mental health treatment, the deeper your mystical experience, the more likely you are to break the hold of sometimes treatment-resistant depression or, you know, alcohol problems that have not responded to any other mainstream medicine. So if you get the set and setting right, you can have a very profound, transformative experience. Mm. And so that is where the responsible use of the substance comes in. And it's very easy with experienced people to get the kind of support and set and setting right. Mm. Unfortunately, because most Westerners have not been schooled in how to use these substances appropriately,
they had a bad trip at the
exactly.
disco and
absolutely. And I mean, you know, so I mean, through my own experience and research over the past few years, I've used psilocybin mushrooms many times recreationally, and I've done some of the really deep dose therapeutic sessions with responsible supervisors. So I'm getting a sense of how the substance works and how transformative it can be. And yes, I think, I mean, the interesting thing is within 5 years, this will be mainstream medicine in the States and the UK and Australia. And because of changing legislation there, it's going to open the door for the substance to be used in medical rooms here, even though we're struggling to get the legislative change around it still being an illicit substance.
Yeah, that's hard to imagine, hey? A doctor prescribing a little dose of magic mushrooms for somebody in their rooms.
So this is how it'll work. So it's not like an SSRI where you get your script from your doctor, you go to your pharmacist gives you 30 days worth of tablets, you take it home and you take a tablet a day. What will probably happen is your psychiatrist or your psychologist, your psychiatrist or your GP will prescribe it. It's a long time away from having the structures in place, but you would go probably to some kind of facility, a clinic, where you have, where you would check yourself in. You would have a medical person screen you to make sure that you're appropriate for the treatment, although your doctor would have already done that. And then that doctor will supervise you through a setting in that context. So you're not going to go to your pharmacy, get the medicine, go home and take it on your own at home. You will go to a facility where you're supported. I can give you an example of how the Johns Hopkins and the Imperial College London people do the work.
Who are the people that are taking this drug then? Because you talk about... So just before we continue, because there's like recreational use, there's spiritual enlightenment, and there's actually you're trying to sort of resolve some medical issue. Are you talking? Yes. It'll be that third group that will now be receiving this. It's not like I want to go and get some good shit from the doctor and go on a trip. You've got to have something wrong with you or some.
So
you're trying to alleviate some medical.
Condition.
Condition is the word I was looking for.
There are two big communities out there. There's this underground community that understands the benefits of using psilocybin, whether it's for self-actualization or to treat sort of mental health conditions. So these are people who are using the substances relatively responsibly in the underground because it's illegal.
Yeah.
But now... The clinical trials that I'm talking about, this is a revival of research that was actually being done in the 40s, 50s, and 60s in a medical context. Just quickly, because when these psychedelics escaped the medical lab in the 60s and became part of this counterculture, the Nixon administration kind of bullied the UN into making the substances illegal.
Right.
And then that for 50 years shut down all of this research. Mm. But the research has actually come back. So for the past sort of 15, 20 years, there's been a resurgence in this research and some very exciting things coming through. And so these clinical trials that I'm talking about, these are being done by Johns Hopkins, by Imperial College London, New York University, a number of others. And they're specifically taking in people who have either treatment-resistant depression. So this is these are people who have they're gravely ill often. Depression can be life-threatening for some people.
Sure.
Can in fact be terminal. So they're taking in people with serious depression that hasn't responded to other drugs or talk therapy, or else they're taking in people with alcohol dependence. People struggling with end-of-life anxiety, that terrible, what they call the existential slap that happens when you are told that you have an untreatable cancer, for instance. Mm. And they're putting people through a 12-week, pretty much what amounts to a 12-week program, where every week the person goes in for ordinary talk therapy. So just, you know, as if you're going to see your shrink for a chat. And they will have several sessions where they prepare for a psychedelic session. And then in the middle of the treatment, they will have two deep-dose psychedelic sessions using psilocybin. So in that context, they're using lab-synthesized psilocybin. They don't use dried magic mushrooms, which the underground is using.
Mm.
But essentially, the first dose will amount to about the equivalent of about 2 grams of dried mushrooms per 70 kilograms of body weight. And the second dose, which I think might be a week or two later, amounts to the equivalent of about 4 grams of dried mushrooms. And what these, basically you'll have two therapists sitting with you. They put you in a very comfortable lounge-type environment with beautiful music playing. You'll have an eye mask on to cut out light because that can be a bit distracting. And in that deep dose session, they'll play a beautifully curated music playlist because that really is instrumental in having this numinous experience.
Right.
And and basically you become your own therapist in that moment, and it's kind of you have a deep subjective experience in that space. The therapists won't really be talking with you. They might hold your hand if you're feeling a bit bewildered, because you know what happens in the psychedelic state is you may not be able to move your body because you're kind of intoxicated in a way, but not like alcohol. You know, with alcohol, when you're intoxicated, your mind goes blank, you stop forming memories. With a deep dose psychedelic experience, it's very different. It may feel like your body is dissolving, but inside your mind, it's this massively mind-expanding experience where for the first hour, you will see the most extraordinary visuals. They call it the sacred geometry. It's like looking into, I don't know, the top of a domed cathedral that's covered with the most beautiful mosaics, and all of the mosaics are moving, and you have a sense of being in the presence of the divine. It's extraordinary. And then what often happens after that is you start to make sense of your life. People describe it as 10 years of therapy in one night. You start to, and you have this incredible experience of love and understanding, okay, so this is how the world works. So that is why you have this profound subjective experience in that session. But then something happens in the mechanics of the brain as well that seem to result in these positive changes in mood and behavior that can have been documented to last for months after that single dosing session, which we can talk about in a minute. But to get back to the clinical trials, so a few talk therapy sessions, your 2-gram dose, a bit of a break, then the bigger 4-gram dose, and then you'll have several talk therapy sessions afterwards to help integrate what happened in those dosing sessions. Incidentally, in the underground community, when they do what they call these mushroom journeys, people are generally encouraged to take the equivalent of about 5 grams of mushrooms, which is a big dose. You pretty much can't move when you're in that state. You have to be supervised. But, I mean, the interesting thing that's coming out of these clinical trials is that people who have not responded to traditional SSRIs, for instance, for depression, they haven't responded to years of therapy, they do these 2 dosing sessions. And months later, their family's reporting that they're different. They're reporting that they, you know, it's not a cure-all for absolutely everyone, but some people with what looks like treatment-resistant depression, these dosing sessions are breaking the hold of it.
It's pretty, I mean, you know, to coin a phrase, mind-blowing.
It is mind-blowing.
To just consider that, and you say that it's going to become part of mainstream medicine in certainly the United States or the UK in the next couple of years.
Within 5 years. The interesting thing is in South Africa, what used to be called the Medicines Control Council of South Africa, it's now the South African Health Products Regulatory Authority. There's a process within that. It's called a Section 21 application process where you can apply to SAHPRA to get a permit to use a medicine in South Africa that isn't licensed here. But if it's licensed in a country abroad, you can apply to use this as an orthodox, unlicensed medicine in South Africa. Huh. So as soon as psilocybin is licensed,
becomes FDA approved, yes, or whatever, it's on the list then of...
Yes.
Oh, wow.
So psilocybin is going to be approved by the FDA within 3 years, if not sooner.
Whoa.
It will be licensed for medical use in the UK probably within 5 years, and Australia is next in line. So as soon as those 3 countries have it, a license there for medical use, our doctors here can apply to SAHPRA to use it as an orthodox unlicensed medicine. The problem is that our medical community is not talking about this at all, or very, very few people are. It's a very safe substance to use. It is has massive potential. The bottleneck is in having skilled people who are able to administer.
Right.
And that means psychiatrists, psychologists, nurses, social workers.
Because, I mean, if I can try and tie it into climate change, I mean, we say that the poorest of the poor are going to face the biggest impact from climate change, and they're going to be probably the least accessible to this kind of therapy, the psychedelic drug therapy that you're talking about, right?
Okay, so the potential for South Africa, this is another whole podcast all on its own, and maybe I can't go into as much detail as I would like to. There are 2 communities that have mental health needs in regards to, or where psilocybin could be applicable. there are poor communities who are dealing with the day-to-day violence of poverty as it is. And there are huge mental health implications there. And already, I mean, I think we have something like, I think something like 3 out of 4 South Africans who need mental health support from the state aren't able to get it. That's how big the gap is, the treatment gap is. So there is huge opportunity to roll this kind of treatment out at scale. But it does need to be handled very responsibly and appropriately. I could speak for an hour on that. To link this with the kind of existential breakdown that I'm talking about around climate change is, you know, for people working at the forefront of climate change activism and response, this big, you know, these communities calling for big systemic change and dealing with the kind of existential breakdown that I was talking about earlier, where you feel completely impotent in the face of the massive revolution that we need to bring. The potential for psilocybin in that community is enormous. And by that I mean there's a comparison to be made between when someone gets a terminal diagnosis and what often happens is the slump into a deep despair and meaninglessness, you know, when you realize that you only have so many pages left in the book of your life. You're confronted with that reality, and a lot of people become incredibly despondent and depressed. And psilocybin has been absolutely transformative for people to deal with that existential distress. And even some of the Imperial College London work has shown that. The comparison with people working in the climate change space is that it really is, when you finally do grasp how serious the situation is, it is literally like realizing that as a society you have a terminal cancer diagnosis. There's this massive existential sort of crisis that comes in when you realize that as a species our days might be numbered. And if psilocybin can help individuals deal with that sort of end-of-life anxiety, how can it help communities that feel despondent and distraught and overwhelmed by the enormity of the climate response? How can it help people find meaning and resilience and purpose at the same time as bringing about that anti-establishment need to disrupt? And I mean, it's interesting that a lot of people in the Extinction Rebellion community have dabbled with psychedelics, whether it's psilocybin mushrooms, ayahuasca, LSD, peyote. It brings about this anti-establishment thinking and an urgency to drive revolution.
Leonie, I think we're going to have to leave it there. I think it was a nice note to finish on.
I think so. I think I've kept talking for a very long time. So.
Far out and scary all at the same time, I have to say. For me, it's quite a long journey before we, I think, see psychedelic medicine, psilocybin, available to the wider population anytime soon, even in the context of the National Health Insurance Bill now under discussion. But it is a fascinating concept, and I urge you to do some further reading. I'm certainly going to do the same. There's quite a lot out there. Johns Hopkins, as she's mentioned, Imperial College in London, amongst others. You can find Leonie's writings, musings, on her website. I'll put a link to that on the Audio Boom, her Voices from Africa page. She also writes regularly for the Daily Maverick. And I'll also post a link to the Psychonauts page. That's Leonie's audio journey into psychedelic medicine. Voices from SA is hosted on Audio Boom. You may subscribe to Voices from SA via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Radio Public, Deezer, or indeed wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your colleagues, tell your friends, tell the world. Until next time, I'm Nicholas Claude. Cheers.